Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Have you ever walked into an art gallery thinking about what it might be like to actually own a priceless masterpiece? You know, they do talk about investing in art all the time, but that's really been for the ultra wealthy. What if it didn't have to be? There's this company called Masterworks, and they are helping everyday people invest in blue chip artwork from artists like Andy Warhol, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of like a mutual fund. Scott Lin, founder and CEO of Masterworks, is going to be here to tell us how it works. Then, who has been the hardest hit financially in the past year? I mean, yeah, of course, everyone, but worse for young people, for women. Morneau Chappelle recently released its financial well-being index, and it is a wake-up call, in particular, for employers and policymakers. Idan Schlesinger from Morneau Chappelle is going to be here to highlight some of the big findings from that study. And in these uncertain times, emotional investing can get the best of us. That's why we often turn to financial advisors to give us the best advice when it comes to handling our money. But are they really completely equipped to help clients when it comes to managing our emotions? Greg Davies from Oxford Risk will be here to answer that question. Then, investing 101 in high school. Junior Achievement has an investment strategies program for students to teach them about the ups and downs. We'll hear from the CEO of JA Central Ontario and the high school student who beat out 2,000 other students for best portfolio performance. Plus, we'll get schooled on the difference between a financial advisor and a financial coach. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. Investing in art for the ultra wealthy, that is a perfectly appropriate and accessible strategy. For the rest of us, it sounds like an elitist pipe dream until now. My next guest founded a company that lets anyone invest in artwork created by renowned artists like Andy Warhol, among others, using a model that's kind of similar to a mutual fund. Scott Lin is the founder and CEO of Masterworks. He joins us now from New York City to tell us how it works. Hello there.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Company's been around for what, 3 years? Where did the idea come from?
You know, I've been collecting art for nearly 20 years, have an important collection in the US, and have also been starting technology companies for the same amount of time. So just had the idea for Masterworks, basically because I had seen my own collection appreciate in value, but recognized that it's a very hard asset class for someone to allocate to unless you have millions of dollars to buy a painting. So the idea behind Masterworks was to securitize paintings and sell shares in them.
I have oversimplified it by calling it a mutual fund for pieces of art. Is that accurate? Is that a fair summary?
Well, today people really invest in individual paintings. So they come to our website and they pick and choose which paintings they want to invest in. So we don't have a fund offering, but we plan to do that later this year.
But they can buy something fractional. They don't have to buy the whole thing.
That's right.
What is the experience for the investor? How do they choose amongst the artwork on your site? What sort of due diligence do you need to do on them to make sure that this is a fit?
We have 120,000 investors signed up on the platform now. Wow. So it's very, very easy to sign up. You come to masterworks.io, create an account, schedule a call with our membership team who effectively walks people through how to think about the art market, how to think about returns, how to think about risk. Talks about their portfolio and what the best way to allocate to art is, just like you think about allocating to stocks or fixed income or any other asset class.
I don't know about art, but I know what I like. That's the cliche phrase. A stock has a price earnings multiple. How do you value art?
The way I tell people to think about it is art is valued very similar to real estate. So we look at individual artists and individual paintings and how those paintings have appreciated historically, comparables really. And then we use that to determine appreciation rate for individual works and to estimate how to think about future value.
So the homepage of your site, it has a picture of a painting on there, but it also has performance versus the S&P 500, which kind of surprised me. How do you think about long-term performance?
Well, when you look at contemporary art specifically, and really when we say contemporary art, we mean art created after World War II. That segment of the art market is appreciated at about 13.7% post-World War II. So it's this very interesting segment of the market that produces returns above the S&P that we think really has a place in any portfolio.
How do you determine which paintings to include? And are you buying them outright and storing them in a vault 2,000 miles under the earth? How does that, what are the logistics here? Do you have a vault? Are you staring at a Renoir right now?
Yeah. So the art market actually has very high-end storage facilities that most collectors use to house these multi-million dollar paintings. Ours is actually based in Delaware because it allows us to avoid sales and use tax on these transactions. But that's a pretty typical structure that most collectors use. In terms of how do we select paintings for the platform, we really go through a two-step process. So we have an internal research team at Masterworks that analyzes data on the art market to understand which artists or what segments are appreciating most quickly. And then once that research team determines which artists are most investable, we have an acquisitions team that goes out and tries to find examples by those particular artists. So for example, today, we're really focused on 40 or 45 artists this year. And I think we've seen over 2,100 paintings by those artists. So we're buying, you know, roughly 1% of what we see.
How often does the portfolio turn over, or does it? Is it a buy and hold?
It's really a buy and hold. We tell investors to think about art as a 7 to 10 year illiquid hold. Now we do have trading markets. We launched trading markets middle of last year. So now investors can trade shares in paintings just like you would trade shares in companies. But we still tell people to think about these as long-term illiquid holds.
When we think about stocks, there's a value style of investing where you hope to buy a quality company cheap. And there is a growth style where you hope you're going to, you know, buy into the next Apple. How do you think about new artists that are the up and comers?
It's a great question. Most of what we focus on, I would describe as a momentum strategy. So it's really the growth strategy. So we're looking at artists who are accelerating quickly, independent of how value oriented we are when we purchase those paintings. Now it's interesting because when you look at different artists, there are certain artists like Basquiat who are not necessarily new artists or emerging artists, but they still have very predictable high appreciation rates. I think our latest data on Basquiat has him appreciating at something like 18% a year for the past 20 years. So you can find these growth opportunities from very old artists.
What is the dynamic of an artist who is no longer living? And I know that's a bit of a morbid question for me to ask, but does it help or hinder that some of your artists are no longer of this earth?
Yeah, I get this question a lot. And the best way that I describe it is one of the things that drives returns in the art market is scarcity. So when an artist is living and they create so many paintings during their lifetime, they pass away, and then the collectors that own those paintings donate them to museums. So the supply is continuously shrinking for great artists. And that really drives prices upward. So when an artist passes away, there's nothing particularly special about them passing away. It just means that they're no longer making art. And over time, the supply will continuously decrease.
With a hedge fund, the fees are 2 and 20. With a mutual fund, the fee is a 2.3% management expense ratio. How do you help investors understand how your fees work?
Our fees are very similar to hedge funds. So our management fees are 1.5% per year plus 20% of profit when a painting sells. So it's very similar to hedge funds or private equity.
What's the art market like right now? Is it doing well because nobody has anything else to do and they're sitting at home thinking about what's on their walls? Or is it doing poorly because people are concerned about the future?
Yeah, so the art market, and qualitatively, this is the best way to think about it, is really correlated today to the top 1% on a global basis. And it's important to understand that it's a global market because roughly 25% of the art market is in the US. So you kind of have to think of how the top 1% globally is behaving. And for better or for worse, COVID hasn't had a large impact on the top 1%. So I think
it's been amazing for the top 1%.
It's arguably been amazing. Yeah. So when you look at prices in the art market, you know, in the first half of 2020, I think 19 artists set price records, which is pretty incredible. So we have seen volume go down because auctions haven't been happening. But prices continue to go up.
Yeah. And I shouldn't be glib. It's been heartbreaking for, the bottom probably 50%, but amazing for the top 1%. I do want to ask about asset allocation. And I keep bringing back to a traditional investing framework because that's what our listeners are are used to. What is the role of art in a portfolio outside of passion? Because I'm sure you have clients who are like, I love this stuff. I can't believe I get to own a piece of Andy Warhol. It's amazing. And then there are others who might have a higher priority on returns.
Yeah, so we did the first correlation study with Citigroup on the asset class a couple of years ago, and essentially concluded that art was uncorrelated, meaning that it really does have a role in any investment portfolio. Citi, independent of us, did an asset allocation model where they looked at art against other asset classes, both from a return perspective, a risk perspective, and a correlation perspective. And they concluded, depending on the investor's tolerance for illiquidity, that the right allocation should be somewhere between 1.8 and 8% of a portfolio. So that's kind of in the general range of what we tell investors to think about.
I want to ask about liquidity and illiquidity. If someone decides they need to get out, how do they do that? And how hard is it for them to do that?
So today, the only way to get out of these investments is through our secondary market. So you can log into the secondary market or the trading section of the website and sell your shares to other investors, similar to how you would sell shares in a public company. Now, you know, these are obviously not exchange-traded securities, so they're not highly liquid like something like, you know, a share of Google might be. But we do see investors all the time trading out of shares at reasonable prices within reasonable timeframes.
What other risks would you flag for people whose interests you have piqued?
Well, if you believe that our prices, which we do, are correlated to growth in the top 1%, then the risks are really the you know, anything that could hurt the top 1%. So we think about things like government regulation, wealth taxes, anything that's really targeting the wealth profile of the top 1% on a global basis.
Kind of an interesting values call. Hey, if you're someone who's concerned about income inequality and poverty and those sorts of things, it's hard to be rooting for the financial well-being of the 1%.
I think that's right. I mean, there's different ways to look at it. And clearly in today's world, we are living in two different economies. But purely from an investment perspective, you know, we think that the top 1% still has a lot of growth ahead of it.
Wow. Well, I hope you donate a Picasso to a food bank every once in a while. If you haven't thought of it, there's a big suggestion. It'll help you with ESG.
Yeah, we are. I mean, we have an initiative at Masterworks to loan out all of the paintings in the collections to institutions as soon as COVID opens back up. That is part of the plan. And we like that idea because it's cool to think about these paintings being owned or at least seen in the general public while co-owned by lots of investors.
Right. Better than a bomb shelter in Delaware.
Exactly.
Scott, thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Bruce.
Scott Lin is the founder and CEO of a company called Masterworks. They have made the idea of investing in art available for a much larger segment of people.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
So many Canadians have been struggling with their financial well-being since this pandemic began. And it is a challenge reflected all over the place in Morneau-Chappell's Financial Well-Being Index. The index is about calculating the financial well-being of the population, but really to understand some of the nuances across region and gender and jobs. Joining me now to share some highlights of the index is Idan Schlesinger. He is the president of Retirement Solutions and executive vice president of Morneau-Chappell. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Good to talk to you.
I get pitched a ton of these surveys because most of them are just marketing. This is not marketing. Who is this index intended for?
I'd say this index is mostly intended for employers across Canada who are looking to understand the challenges that their employees are going through. We've been running our mental health index for some time, and it really focuses in on the mental health challenges of employed Canadians. And one of the key findings from that index was that the biggest driver of stress or mental health challenges for employed people is financial uncertainty. And so we chose to create this new index to really, as you said, go deeper on the financial stress side of the equation to really understand what is driving challenges that people do have.
The index is down 2.8%. 2.8 points, rather. Put that into context. What is that number? What does it mean?
Well, what we're comparing there is how people are doing across the financial spectrum. So we look at financial knowledge, financial behavior, resiliency, and perception to put together this composite view of how people are generally doing financially. And this is the first index of its kind. So we're comparing to a pre-pandemic benchmark right now to 2019, and really trying to assess how people have changed. And the score that we're seeing is we would class as a severe decline in overall financial health. Now, it varies by spectrum, and it varies, as we said before, by a lot of demographic factors. But this would definitely be a severe decline in overall health.
Young people have the lowest score, folks 20 to 29. Why do you believe that is?
Yeah, it's an interesting finding. I'd say there's probably a few drivers there. One is probably the nature of the employment that young people would tend to be in. I'd say they'd be overrepresented in industries that have been hit the hardest. Think about the entertainment or hospitality industries. They're also likely to have less seniority, less experience, and be more vulnerable to reductions in hours or to being laid off. And then the other interesting aspect is the one of knowledge and experience, and they just haven't built up that resiliency, that financial expertise that people usually build up over years and decades, which really protects a lot of older people against some of the stress and some of the changes that we are experiencing.
There's a big difference men versus women here. And if this was a mental health well-being score, it wouldn't surprise me at all, given the load that many women carry in the family, regardless of what's going on in the workplace. But why do you believe that there is lower financial well-being amongst women than men?
Again, a very interesting finding. Part of it, probably similar to the age finding, may have to do with the types of jobs that women are overrepresented in, and the industries that maybe hit harder. But I think another aspect and one which we can't ignore is that women probably do bear overrepresented in the strain of dealing with children, dealing with families during the pandemic. And so we've seen many situations where women are either leaving their jobs or reducing their hours because mm-hmm. of the other family or related strains that are disproportionately placed upon them.
You have a lower score if you have a child, but it improves a bit if you have 3+. How do you make sense of that?
That was an interesting one. And I think
is that because you're sending your children out to work? And so they're actually, 11-year-olds bringing in some income?
So we didn't ask that particular question.
Right.
But it is an interesting one. We found that people without children or with 3 or more children are impacted less than people with 1 or 2. And I think the notion of having children making it more challenging than not having children makes a lot of sense. In terms of 3+ children, it may be that people with 3 or more children have already structured their lives in a way that give them a little bit more resiliency and more flexibility. But that's probably something we'd want to explore further down the road, because it was a bit of a counterintuitive result for us.
Now, we talked off the top about this being for employers principally, because they want their people to be making those widgets and making the world a better place. How do you draw the connection here between financial well-being and productivity?
Well, there's a couple of connections. The first one is simply when we do look at the link to mental health, and that we have found historically that financial uncertainty is the biggest driver of mental health challenges. But the other really fascinating one, and this definitely came out in the study, is that 1 in 5 people report that their financial concerns are directly impacting their productivity at work, that it is a distraction that is on their minds all the time, and it is actually affecting what they can do. And related to that, we found that 1 in 10 people in regular full-time employment are supplementing their income from gig employment, from additional jobs that they're taking on the side, and that those people are particularly susceptible to mental stress and to strain. So I think you put those together and you definitely find a vulnerable population within almost any employee group.
many of our listeners bring two perspectives to this conversation. The one, of course, is as an individual living in the times that we're living in. But the second is as a manager, a leader, a business owner. What's the call to action here for employers in supporting their people in the area of finances?
Well, we'd always say that finances are a pretty personal and individual factor, and we see how demographics play a strong role in that. So there's a limit to how much employers and managers can actually do, but there's also a great opportunity. We find that people really do trust their employers. They look to their employers as a source of unbiased information, of information they can rely on and of support that they can rely on. And so for employers, given that there is a strong vested interest, what we would really encourage is that they do a few things. One is that they actively engaged on the topic with their employees, that they look to understand where vulnerabilities are among their populations and what kind of support is needed. And then secondly, to look very closely at the programs that they do offer, whether it is pension or retirement savings programs or other types of investments or education programs, and really look to understand, are these programs achieving the goal that they're looking to achieve? Are they targeting the right groups within my population? Are they recognizing the differences within the population, as we said before, be it age or gender or other, to really make sure that they're delivering on the goals that the employer is looking to achieve?
It's going to take the employers, it's going to take the individuals, it's going to take the government, it's going to take all of it and all of us to get this train back on the tracks. Idan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Bruce. It's my pleasure.
Idan Schlesinger is president of Retirement Solutions at Morneau Chappell, and he was here to talk about this initial read of financial well-being. It is not a great picture. Clearly, there is more to be done. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, Greg Davies from Oxford Risk is going to be here to talk about emotional investing. And later, financial coaches, what are they? How do they differ from financial advisors? We'll talk to Tanya Oliva from FinSmart. Now, if you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, very simple to do that. We have a monthly newsletter. It brings together this show, CBC Radio. I do a weekly column there. Cityline, BNN Bloomberg. Go to moolala.ca, pop your email address in there. It'll come to you once a month, and I won't do anything else with your email address.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I would like to think that I am a logical, rational, and an analytical thinker when it comes to my money, but that is probably wishful thinking, given that I happen to be a member of the human race. And listen, you are too, and so is your financial advisor if you have one. Emotions are inextricably linked to our behavior. The behavioral finance people at a company called Oxford Risk argue that many financial advisors are poorly equipped to help clients deal with their emotions as it relates to investing, not their marriage, their investing. So joining me now to talk about this is Greg Davies, head of behavioral finance at Oxford Risk. He joins us from London, England. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Why do you say that financial advisors are poorly equipped to help clients deal with the emotions around investing? What proof do you have of that?
It's largely because the financial advice process has just so many moving parts that advisors need to keep track of. And this is not me having a dig at financial advisors. As you said earlier, it's because we're human. There is stuff that we as humans are just not that good at. And processing lots of data and juggling lots of moving parts and coming to an objective answer is typically the sort of thing that we're not good at. But we have an advantage. We have the ability to build technology and machines that can do the stuff that we're bad at, the data processing, keeping track of things. And, if we want to be the best human advisor we can be, we should be looking to use technology and diagnostic tools to help us be better humans.
So give us some examples of where technology can interrupt or intervene or improve the way that we manage our investments that left to our own emotional selves, we would not do such a good job.
So we could take the example of COVID, right? In the last 12 months, pretty much every person has had their financial circumstances changing faster than they typically do. Some people have lost their jobs, our goals and our plans have changed, we can no longer go traveling, etc. The right answer for your investment solution depends on all of those moving parts. And it is very unlikely that any human advisor with multiple clients is going to simultaneously be able to update all that information on all their clients at the same time under period of stress and come to the right answer. So if we have technology that is busy cranking through the mechanics in the background, keeping track of all the pieces of how your financial picture has moved, and then feeding to the advisor a sort of diagnostic tool that guides them, it means that your answer is more objective, it's less emotion-laden, and it's less stress-laden, and it's more likely to be accurate.
What are some variables that you believe are important to consider that people might not either be aware of or prioritize in the same way?
So the traditional advice process says we need to understand risk tolerance. I need to understand your willingness to trade off risk and return in the long term, how much you're willing to take on the chance of a loss in order to get a chance of a higher gain in the future. That's all well and good. The problem is that we don't live in the long term. You and I do not live in the long term. And your risk tolerance is an essential part of the right answer. But we need to consider other aspects of your financial personality. So your composure, for example. Are you the sort of person who is very calm, collected, laid back? Or are you the sort of person who is psychologically engaged with the here and now, with the present at every moment? And unless I know something about your composure levels and your anxiety levels, I'm very unlikely to be able to guide you effectively in making good investment decisions, because all I'm seeing is the parts of you that the traditional theory wants me to see. So there are all number of aspects of financial personality that actually influence your decision-making massively and indeed influence the right answer for you massively.
And how do you get that data? I mean, if you were interviewing me for, you know, the CEO of, I don't know, Pfizer or Bank of America, you'd pay an industrial psychologist a gazillion dollars and they put me through a battery of tests. And of course, I would get the offer because I'm amazing. But how do you get that data on investors? Because that's not an easy ask.
It's not dissimilar. I mean, we have a battery of tests. One of the things that we specialize at in Oxford Risk is the design of psychometric questionnaires to assess your financial personality. And we can measure it on up to 15 different dimensions, including your attitudes towards ESG and responsible investing and things. Mm. So if we put you through, and it wouldn't be a battery of tests, we can put you through a set of questions that will take you less than 3 minutes to complete. And that won't give you all 15 dimensions, but that will give you three or four key scores that will enable us to place you relative to the baseline population. So we'll know where you sit in terms of low, medium, and high on each of those three or four scores. And each of those things, the risk tolerance, composure, it might be impulsivity, for example, every single one of those tells us something that we should be doing differently in how we communicate with you, in how we build a portfolio, in how we hold your hand when the markets get volatile next week.
How do you get the data on impulsivity? Do you put a chocolate brownie in front of me and then start a stopwatch like over Zoom and see how long I cannot jam that entire brownie into my face?
Adult version of the marshmallow test.
Yes. Yeah. I'm just not so interested in marshmallows. Brownies, on the other hand.
We don't do that. I mean, we have very, very simple questions. And so there will be what psychologists will call a like it scale. We ask you, we put a statement in front of you, and then we say, how much do you agree or disagree with this statement? And that is super simple. Where it's not simple is the way we've chosen those questions comes from us collecting data on hundreds of different questions from thousands of different investors around the world. So it's the statistical techniques behind it that say, if I ask you these three questions, those are the most effective questions I can ask you in terms of me accurately placing you on an impulsivity scale. And once I've got that, I know something stable about your personality. That means you are going to act differently in certain market conditions or to certain investments.
I hope you have very creative names for all of the archetypes you create. I could be like a purple tortoise or something like that. What would that mean to the advisor? So you do all that research, I get a label, or there's certain guardrails put on my portfolio based on the majesty that is my humanity. Mm-hmm. How does that change what the advisor buys and sells?
So the real future of this is you, and we're working on this with a number of large clients around the world at the moment, you embed that deeply into technology. So when the advisor comes in to sit down at their desk on a Monday morning, our algorithms are cranking away in the background and they say, markets were volatile this week. Your clients, client number 8, number 15, and number 23, we know their portfolio dropped last week. We know they logged in over the weekend, so they know that it has dropped. We know that this person is low composure, high impulsivity, etc. These are the clients that you need to pick up the phone and talk them off the ledge, because they're the ones who are in the most stressed circumstances.
Or send them a scented candle, which would scented be another... Candle.
The point is, absolutely, the point is here, you're providing advisors a guidance system that enables them to hyper-personalize what they say to each and every client on a week-by-week basis. And so it's guided handholding to try and help investors to mitigate the emotional responses to what is invariably a volatile and a rocky ride.
At what level of assets does a financial advisor have an ability to engage in this level of detail? Because, you know, I talk to advisors all the time and they have such a challenge dealing with regulations and keeping up with the stock market and handholding in the simplest sense. They may have, I can see some of them listening to this conversation thinking, when would I have a chance to call all my people?
Well, I mean, that is another reason why human advisors are somewhat ill-equipped for this process. So actually, the use of technology in these things, it's doing a lot of the heavy lifting for you. It's providing you with the answer, having looked at your client's psychological makeup, and it's tracking their balance sheet, and it's feeding it to you through technology. So actually, what it is doing is it's expanding the proportion of clients that you can serve effectively rather than reducing it. And you know, our target, our sweet spot here is actually in the mass affluent market, where you're talking about advisors who have many, many clients with relatively modest proportions to invest.
So it would be like a bionic CRM, customer relationship management
absolutely.
Kind of application.
Absolutely. In our more whimsical moment, we talk about decision prosthetics. So the use of technology to help humans be better decision makers.
Wow. Does it mean you ignore the stoic client, or does she get a call, you know, every couple of years?
Yeah, you let them tick away with it, and every now and then, in extreme times, a little warning flag might.
Right. You send her a pizza. I was thinking of
exactly.
You.
Exactly. But Greg, really interesting true stoics stuff. Are few and far between.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Greg Davis, head of behavioral finance at Oxford Risk. And we were talking about some of the cutting edge technology that may help advisors account for the emotions of their clients. Coming up later, the difference between a financial advisor and a financial coach. Tanya Oliva from FinSmart will be here. But first, Junior Achievements Investment Strategies Program, getting young people engaged with the stock market at a young age. Want some more Moolala? You can head over to our website, moolala.ca. You can listen to past episodes. You can search for particular segments. If you're listening to this on a podcast platform, while you're there, subscribe to the show. It automatically just shows up. You don't have to do anything. It's just going to be on your device.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Do you remember the first time you invested something in the stock market? For some of you, it's been a while. For some people, it's a more recent memory. But I bet if you think back, you were not diving into the stock market in high school. Junior Achievement has an investment strategies program that teaches high school kids about the ups and downs of trading in the market. And we're going to hear more about that program today. Joining us now is Jennifer Holmes-Weir, President and CEO of JA Central Ontario, and Julian Kokonofsky. He is a grade 11 student at John Cabot Catholic Secondary School and the winner of the last JA Investment Strategies Program competition. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Julian, having congratulations. You beat out 2,000 other students. What was that experience like for you?
The experience was actually pretty once in a lifetime. It's pretty hard to win a provincial tournament, but even to win a country tournament, that's even better. And that's what we did in December.
Tell us about your strategy. Were you like, I don't know, were you conservative or did you just swing for the fences with every single pick you made?
So I started off conservative. So I was going like, I had a $150,000 balance off the start and I split that up into three categories. And for the first 2 weeks, I was doing very, very slow. Not making a lot of money, maybe $50,000 in the first week, first 2 weeks. And then I went all in into all the companies. And just before the president elections of America, I was studying some of the stocks, which would go up if either president would win. And I placed my money on Joe Biden winning. And that's how I pretty much won the stock market competition of JA.
What was your best pick? What was your best performer of all?
So I started the best ticker was FCEL, F-C-E-L. It started off from $2.90. And when I sold it, I sold it one afternoon, then I bought it one morning. So it was on and off for a week. And it rose up to like $9 by the end of the competition. But right now it's at like 27.
So and it's a fuel cell company, is it?
Yeah, fuel cell company, green energy.
Okay, and what about a dog? Did you have like a complete dog?
Not really.
You just won left, right, and center.
Yeah, I went all in into those stocks, those tickers. There was another pharmaceutical, Pfizer, I'm pretty sure. But
yeah, I've heard Pfizer. It. I think they might have something in the vaccine. Area. Yeah. I want to ask you, what would you say is one or two things that you learned from your participation in this program?
Even if you lose, you can't stay off track. So don't follow the train when it derails, you know? So just go and have a mindset. If you lose, you lose. And if you win, you win. Just don't get overexcited. The competition ends whenever.
But Jennifer, I'm sure you feel this as well. I want to be back in grade 11 again and just give Julian my newspaper route money and have him turn it into whatever, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Tell us, we can't do that though. Tell us about the investment strategies program at JA.
Absolutely. So the and Julian, I mean, maybe he should be managing for me today, right? By the sounds of it, my goodness. JA's ISP, so Investment Strategies Program, it's a national program developed by JA Canada that we offer to students across our region. Our region encompasses the GTA and further beyond the GTA. There's about 12 different school boards who participate. And so the program has two different parts. The first is an in-class or this year virtual teacher-led program with four modules that focus on key investment principles. And then as Julian was just showcasing for us, there's Invest JA, which is the 6-week competition where students research and manage their own simulated stock portfolios using live data from North American stock markets. So they work alone or in teams to build their portfolio and they trade over the course of 6 weeks with a mock $100,000 to begin. And the students with the highest equity at the end of the 6 weeks win.
Wow. Now, one of the things that, you know, we kind of need an asterisk around is this is a trading competition because it's so short term in nature. How do you include the idea of buy and hold or saving for retirement? Or are we just training our young people to trade like it's the Wild West?
What we're actually doing here is giving them a safe, structured learning environment to develop the foundations for a successful future. So yes, we're teaching those technical skills and investment principles, but as Julian was telling in his story, sometimes in life, the train derails, right? So we're also teaching them and those important soft skills around building confidence and flexibility and self-efficacy. We're helping prepare them for the ups and downs, the uncertainty and the unexpected. So in that way, it's a fantastic preparation for the changing world and for a shifting economy. It's that ability to bring together the investing principles together with real world experiences.
Julian, there are top-down investors and bottoms-up investors. The top-down who are picking like big thematic ideas and investing based on those, and others who are really getting into the analysis of particular stocks. Which is your focus, if I asked you to make that distinction?
In the competition, I was analyzing most of the companies, but in my portfolio, I'd go the better companies, which have a better cap hit over billions of dollars instead of millions. I analyzed a lot of stocks during the competition, and it was all during the weekend, like Saturday, Sunday. On the weekdays, you know, I just went with the flow. Whatever ticker went up, I bought.
How do you feel about what's going on in the market right now? I look at it as someone who's been covering the stock market for decades, and it makes me so nervous to see the crazy moves in BlackBerry and Tilray and GameStop and Bitcoin and all that stuff. Does that excite you or terrify you?
I don't agree with it because BlackBerry it's going to be bankrupt in the next 10 years, that's for sure. Because all the games are going and all the like discs and everything is going
to GameStop,
virtual.
The game, yeah, GameStop. Yeah, yeah.
And then the feeder stock, the CME, I'm pretty sure, or JME, GME, sorry.
AMC, the theater chain. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Their feeders they're all closed due to COVID. So it's kind of stupid that it's going up. There's no point. They're not doing anything revolutionary. Like Tesla, like Apple, or any other stock. But
Jennifer,
yeah.
I hope you're relieved like I am. Julian did learn something from this. This is good. I would have been a little concerned if he'd said, "Woo, GameStop, all or nothing." Jennifer, how do students participate in this program? I know there are multiple waves over the course of the year. How do they find out more about it, and how do they participate?
Individual students can take part and teachers can sign up their whole class. All the information that you need to be able to join ISP is on JA Central Ontario's website, which is jacentralontario.org/ISP.
Is there a cost to participate?
You know, Bruce, thanks so much for asking that question. JA is a charity, and so it's through the generous support of our sponsors and donors that we're able to offer our programs free of charge to educators and students. The upcoming competition is sponsored by AGF, and we're really thankful for their support.
Julian, when you look ahead, so you're in grade 11, when you look ahead, I don't know, 10, 20 years, do you think you would like to work in the investment industry, or is this an awesome hobby that could be something that you do on the side?
I for sure want to work in the investment industry. I always wanted to become a pilot, but due to this, from March, I wanted to research the stock market, and then this competition allowed me to see clearer and open up more room for me to expand my opportunities. And now I want to become like a financial advisor, stockbroker, one of those.
Well, there's certainly an adrenaline hit as a pilot, and there's an adrenaline hit from the stock market too. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks
Always
for having
a pleasure.
Us.
Julian Kokonovsky is a grade 11 student at John Cabot Catholic Secondary. Jennifer Holmes Weir is president and CEO of JA Central Ontario. And they were here to talk about the JA Investment Strategies Program. You got to check it out. It's an amazing program and a huge, huge resource for young people to learn about investing. Stay with us. Coming up next on the program, Tanya Oliva from FinSmart is here to take us through everything you need to know about hiring a financial coach. And we're hanging out on the radio, but I also do a lot of television. I'm the money columnist for CityLine, and you can check out various things that we do on CityLine at cityline.tv. On social, I am at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We always talk about all the different service providers you could retain to help you get a better handle on your money. There are many different kinds. There are financial advisors, there's money coaches, there's all sorts of, there's nonprofit credit counselors, there's licensed insolvency, blah, 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 blah. There's so many. The one distinction that sometimes is hard for people to make is the difference between financial advisors and financial coaches or money coaches. I want to make that very, very clear by talking to a financial counselor and coach today. Her name is Tanya Oliva. She is the founder of FinSmart, and she joins us now from Campbell River, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. It's fantastic to be on your show. Thanks for having
me. Fantastic to talk to you. How is a financial coach different from a financial advisor?
Well, let me just first say that everyone can benefit from financial coaching and counseling, especially people in their younger years. But in the most simplest terms, a financial coach is someone whose core focus is on helping people with money management across all financial behaviors, how we spend, save, borrow, and plan. And ultimately, our goal is to help people build initial wealth. Whereas a financial advisor, their core focus is on helping people invest that initial wealth and then help grow it over time. So that's very simple, but as you can see, it's the difference between money management and investment management.
Mm. With any coach, like when we think about coaches, life coach, sports coach, running coach, dating coach, there is a combination of the head and the heart. So very tangible skills, like how do you calculate your net worth? And then less tangible skills, like how do you deal with emotional spending, et cetera. Give me some examples on where your work engages in those two things.
That is an excellent question, because so many of our decisions and our actions are really guided by our subconscious mind. And so one of the focuses that I have is on our money mindset. And when we think about our mindset, this is the lens through which we see the world. It's how we think, feel, and behave. So FinSmart is really what I define as my money mindset. And it's when we use our money with intention and mindfulness. And so this is really, again, about managing our money. And I like to say, Bruce, mastering our money is a skill. You know, it's not a task. So in order to develop the best behaviors when it comes to your money, you have to have the right mindset, which then infuses the right behaviors.
Mm. You have real world experience here. You had a self-described financial meltdown at age 32. How did you get out of it?
Yes, we all have a money story. And this is my origin story with regards to how I became a financial coach. So Bruce, in the year 2000, I was experiencing a divorce, the loss of my very first career job as a result of an unexpected restructure. And thirdly, as we all will recall in the finance world, the dot-com crash.
Mm.
So in those 6 months, I really was at my bottom. And the very first thing I did was I had to get my financial house in order. You know, I was broke. I'll be honest. It was a very scary and vulnerable time for me. So I, first of all, created a cash flow budget system. And it's a system that I use to this day. I can share with you 20 plus spreadsheets that I've used every year to help me manage my money. And it has been a game changer.
What would you say you learned that you apply with the most regularity, given that you have walked this path yourself?
It's all about, I think, three things. First of all, you know, living within and below your means. You know, if we're going to live above our means, we're always going to be in that paycheck to paycheck and debt cycle. So what I became clear of, Bruce, is knowing what is most important to me, you know, understanding my financial goals, my lifestyle goals, and then using my money to achieve that. And that's really how I've worked. And I've always saved for my future self. This is the other thing that I am trying to educate, you know, people in general on, is don't just think about your present self, think about your future self, because we all are living longer and healthier lives, and we want to maintain a lifestyle throughout our life.
Yeah. You have four A's: awareness, anticipation, action, and achievement in one sentence. Can you tell me what each of those A's mean?
Absolutely. It's bringing your A game to your finances. So awareness is about knowing everything there is to know about your finances. So I'm talking your net worth and your net income. Anticipation is all about your present and future self and making financial decisions that align with your goals and your life vision. Action is all about implementing the best practices and knowing your financial priorities. So it's having that spending plan, debt payment plan, and of course, managing it in an effective way. And the final stage, of course, is achievement. It is about living your best life, aligning your money with your financial priorities and your goals so that, you know, you know that you're on the path to living your best life.
One of the other distinctions between a financial advisor and a financial coach is how one finds and retains a financial coach. Because you can go to any branch of any bank and they're going to pair you with a financial advisor, and that advisor will be compensated, as they should be, typically, you know, at that, in that environment, on the commission that is generated from the sale of a mutual fund. A financial coach, you pay for outright, like you would a life coach or a personal trainer. How much does it cost? How long do those engagements typically last?
That's an excellent question, Bruce. What I can say is that there's not a lot of us out there. This is still a fledgling profession or coaching discipline. I myself am an accredited financial counselor, and my understanding, there's only about 240 of them in Canada, but I expect that to grow. So to find one, you can just do the Google, of course. I'm available at finsmart.ca, but what it costs is really, I take a holistic approach, which we all should, because we cannot make financial decisions in a vacuum. We must know the big picture. So I only take clients on, for example, on a 3-month coaching package. And it really will depend on their circumstances, how complicated or how many are living in the household. But really, it starts at about $1,500 for a full 3-month coaching package to go through that holistic process, that A game of awareness, anticipation, action, and achievement.
And is that $150 an hour or so? Why I think that's really important is to put it in the category of other services that people pay for. They may pay for a physiotherapist or a massage therapist. Is it in that same range?
Yes, it is. And when I share that with my clients, I say that my, you know, session fee is between $100 and $150. And again, that's not only the talk time, but it's also the preparation time and the response time. And I don't say it's by hour, I say it's by session. So our sessions can last an hour and a half, 45 minutes, and sometimes 3 hours. Yes, it's true.
if there were, wow, hope there's a beverage involved, even over Zoom. One final question before we go. If there was one issue that you see more often than any other in your practice, what would it be? And what is the thing that you wish you could, in some ways, record yourself saying that would be your advice on said issue?
Bruce, if I have to choose one thing, it's that most people use mental accounting to manage their money. It's impossible. You know, most wealthy people use a budget or some sort of system to know where their money is going and what they want their money to achieve. If you're trying to pay all of these bills and subscriptions and other expenses just off of your brain activity, it's not going to work and you will not get ahead. So this is why I keep coming back to my success, which is that cash flow budget system I created as I was going through that financial meltdown. And it allowed me within 15 years to achieve financial independence. So it's not about how much we make, it's about how much we keep, as you know. So please, if you're going to be successful with your finances, have a system in place to do that.
A system, and it could well be that a coach would make a difference for you. Thank you so much for your time and your insight, Tanya. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you, Bruce. Keep going. Thank you so much.
Okay. I'll keep going if you will. Tanya Oliva is a financial counselor, financial coach. Her firm is called FinSmart, and she joined us from Campbell River, British Columbia. That's our show. Wow, that was fast. If you would like to stay up to date on all things Moolala, you can subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. You can subscribe to the podcast at whatever platform you happen to listen to the podcast on. And while you're there, hey, write us a review. If you have questions or comments or ideas or requests, ask at moolala.ca is our email address. Ask at moolala.ca. There are so many great resources out there. If you're looking for a personal finance book to get you started, I wrote one, Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. It's available, but you can also go to the library, get it out for free. That'd be good. Thank you so much for joining us and have a great day.